broke. And let's work on master semantic theories. But I will use results and mention some features of super semantic theories, which were considered earlier to work with Chatti, Ehrlich, Jose, Chadmi, and Shirman. Worldwide collaboration. So a look at FTH or FPH reveals that 5D and 6D theories are currently quite popular. And the reason for that popularity on both archives is Owen. In the phenomenological community, 5, 6-dimensional and so on theories offer a useful tool to organize beyond the standard model of Rees's freedom. And there are various mechanisms using that the principle that standard model views can propagate in the extra dimension. So using that principle or paradigm, various mechanisms have been proposed to address or reformulate all kinds of problems of particle physics, mass hierarchies, unification, supersymmetry breaking, and so on. On the TH community, the interest was spawned mostly by some observations made by string theorists. If you look at the gauge couplings in a 5 and 6-dimensional gauge theory, they have dimensions of length, length or length square. And so by eight-power counting, one would conclude that these theories are infrared free and cannot have any interest in dynamics. However, Seibel showed, or argued, that these theories can nevertheless exhibit some interesting behavior. In particular, he noted that the strong coupling limit of these theories can exist, and also he argued, using some string dualities, that these strong coupling limits are described by non-trivial superconformal field theories with various enhanced global symmetries. So this is work done in 96 by Seibel and collaborators later. So these two properties, 1 and 2, were really results of various string dualities, and they're not really expected or understood in field theory. So clearly, since we talked about the strong coupling limit, understanding non-perturbative effects is clearly important. I believe understanding these effects is important for both applications and theories. So what I will study today is some non-perturbative effects in these theories. More particular, more precisely, I will study instanton effects in compactified five-dimensional theories, where in a regime where they are calculable. And I will later present some speculations of what might happen in a regime where they're not calculable. So why do I focus on instantons? The reason I focus on instantons is that they lead to violation of classically conserved quantum numbers. Well-known examples in four dimensions include the violation of d-l by 3 units by SU2 instantons, or the generation of eta prime mass, or the role instantons play in generating the axiom mass in QCD. So these are our real theories we know about, and the role of instantons in them. There are also various fun models that can be studied. For example, in the Seibel-Witten theory, instantons violate the UNR symmetry. And the exact solution of Seibel and Witten can be thought of being a sum of infinite number of instanton contributions. So clearly, I put this transparency just to argue that instantons are important in understanding field theory dynamics. So, if I consider a field theory, a gauge field theory, in 5 or 6-dimensional compactified, for example, a circle or a torus, we expect that the instanton amplitudes will be modified in these theories. And why is that? The reason for that is that, let's first start from 4-dimensional asymptotically free theories. In a 4-dimensional asymptotically free field theory, without any mass scales, the instanton amplitude, as has been known for many years, is essentially proportional to this factor that goes under the name of 2 suppression factor. It's the negative exponent of the negative of a phi squared over g squared, where g squared is the gauge coupling, evaluated at the scale rho. So this is the length scale, which characterizes the size of the instanton. So in the path integral in these asymptotically free theories without any mass scales, one has to integrate over the size of the instanton. In the integral, a priori goes from 0 to infinity. I will not be interested today in large instant dogs. I will be interested in this one, with a little small instant dogs. In an asymptotic delivery theory, the gauge coupling vanishes when the size of rho goes to zero, because this means going to the ultraviolet, and therefore the small instant dog contribution is exponentially suppressed in the path integral. And this is the reason why the amplitude of B minus L violation for the axiom mass or the eta prime mass in four-dimensional physics can be entirely determined by the ultraviolet, by the infrared behavior. And the ultraviolet doesn't matter. So that's the story in four dimensions. So it follows from this consideration that in a compactified five-dimensional theory, generally this story cannot be true. The reason is that, first of all, there is at least one extra mass scale, which is the scale 1 over R, the Kaluza Klein scale. And also, these five-dimensional series are not asymptotically free, they're not even renormalizable. So a generic expectation would be that one expects this amplitude of Baryon number violation for the axiom mass or R charge violation in various square models to receive, in general, UV contributions. So that's the qualitative argument that the amplitude will be changed. So to study this, we need a UV definition of the five-dimensional theory. What I will use in this talk will be deconstruction, because for a general 5D theory, at least as far as I'm concerned, keep my degree, this is for me the easiest way to calculate is to use deconstruction. Before going to deconstruction, however, I want to consider a neat continuum picture and qualitatively discuss what one expects. So let's recall the four-dimensional instanton. The instanton is a solution of the Euclidean equations of motion of Young-Mills theory in four dimensions in R4. And this is the expression for the solutions here. The mu runs from 0 to 3 or 1 to 4. A is the SE2 index. These are some Clapeyron coefficients, never mind. What matters is, for us, what will matter is a kind of a pictorial representation. The instanton is a blob in R4. Which is of some finite size rho, and it has a given center. It has also another parameter, which is the orientation in SE2, but it won't matter for us. And the F mu, the field strength, is essentially non-zero in a region around X naught, this size rho. So that's the four-dimensional BPSD solution. It is a solution of the Young-Mills equation for any rho. So of course, this solution will also solve the 5D Euclidean equations. There are two different ways to interpret this solution when we go to five dimensions. We can study the instanton as a solution which is independent of time. And so, in this case, we can take the time even to be in proxy. In this case, the instanton will be just a soliton. Now we are in five-dimensional theory. We take all these indices u to lie in the four spatial dimensions. So in this case, the instanton is a soliton. It has a size which is a modulus classically, and it has a mass which goes like 8 pi squared over g pi squared. Remember, this 1 over g pi squared has the dimension of the mass. So, of course, this has an infinite action, and so we will not be interested in this, even though this solitonic state could be very important in some problem, but we will not consider it. We are interested in semi-classical contributions to the path integral, so we need something that has a finite action. So what we will consider is the instanton as a solution of the Euclidean five-dimensional equations of motion. It's essentially the same thing, except I say now this coordinate perpendicular to the instanton is x5. The action, of course, is 8 pi squared over g pi squared, the same as here. But now I have to also integrate over dx5, because, well, strictly speaking, this is a tube which expands in this direction. So, of course, if the fifth direction is not compact, this integral divergence in the action is infinite. But for a finite x5, when it is compactified, the classical action of the instanton is 8 pi squared over g pi squared times 2 pi r. So, classically, also in five dimensions, this size rho of the instanton is also a modulus, provided, of course, this size is much bigger than, I apologize, this is an inverse, than the inverse cutoff of the five-dimensional theory. We will call this cutoff, for obvious reasons, V in what follows. And the reason is that this five-dimensional theory at best can be viewed as a low-energy effective theory, so all kinds of higher-dimensional operators are present in the action, and those, of course, are not scale invariant, and will usually fix the effect, will introduce a dependence of the action on the instanton size for very small instanton sizes. So we'll restrict our considerations for instantons, which are much bigger than the five-dimensional length cutoff. So this is written here. So of course, this fact that this rho is a classical modulus is only a classical fact. It's a classical modulus. And the instanton is a non-trivial background, and all fields propagate in this background. And all these fields that propagate in the instanton background will back-react, they will exert forces on this background. So, this is really a cartoon picture. But what happens is we have this instanton of size rho, which is some region where the field strength is non-zero. Outside of this region, the field strength is zero. And on this classical background, there are quantum fluctuations. There are bosons and fermions in the theory, and they back-react on this background. And so what fermions generally try to do, by the Pauli principle, they try to make a background as big as possible, and bosons, on the other hand, try to shrink the background. And the relevant size, rho, of instantons that contribute to the semi-classical amplitude, in the semi-classical approximation, is determined by a balance of the back reaction of the quantum fluctuations of bosons and fermions on this classical BPST background. So what are the fields that fluctuate in the background of this instanton? Well, the fields are the zero modes of the gauge field, and it's this is A50, and the various fermions, and also the various KK modes, which have masses in units 1 over r, they also fluctuate in this background. So, one important property of supersymmetric theories, I promise that I will use results from supersymmetric, is that these Casimir forces vanish. What that means is actually that only the zero modes contribute to the instanton amplitudes. And so this is the supersymmetric case. And this makes calculations of instantons in supersymmetric theories in the high-dimensional very easy. Because in a compact five-dimensional theory, the zero modes are the same as in four-dimensions. And so the amplitude of an instanton process in a compactified five-dimensional or six-dimensional theory is entirely determined by the four-dimensional physics. It's the four-dimensional data function that determines what size instantons contribute. In a general theory, however, we expect that unless there are too many fermions, the amplitudes will grow for small rho. The reason was that the bosons, if there are more bosons in the theory, the instanton wants to get smaller and smaller, and so the relevant configurations are pushed to smaller and smaller distances where the coupling becomes larger and larger. So this is the qualitative expectation that one has. We want to be somewhat more precise. And to be more precise, we will use a particular regulator to discuss the calculation of the amplitude and its dependence on the scale size. So we'll use the construction, which is essentially the lattice version of the higher-dimensional theory. And what we will do is just consider a five-dimensional SU2 theory on a circle, which in the latticized version is the same as the large end limit of four-dimensional SU2 to the NDH theory. You probably all have seen this more than once here. We have a quiver diagram which is depicted here. The circles denote the gauge groups, they're end gauge groups, and they're connected by bifundamental fields which have frozen depths, V. So this is the two lengths of this diagram are written here. So there is a gauge field on the I side, a gauge field on the I plus first side, and a scalar field which is a bifundamental. These scalar fields, or rather their faces, play the role of the latent. The fact that all they have frozen expectation values means that the product gauge group of SU2 to the n is broken down to the diagonal. So in terms of a Lagrangian, it's probably more illuminating for those who haven't seen it, we have a theory of n gauge groups with kinetic terms for all the scalars. Gauge fields, we have kinetic terms for the scalars that are written here in some more detail because we will need this. Link field phi transforms into the I and I plus first gauge group. Well, this should be on the other side. And to satisfy Misha, it's not here anymore. I put the potential that will fix the depths. You can give an expectation value to all the scalars due to this potential, such that it is all equal and minimizes the energy, then this term, the kinetic term for the scalars, becomes a mass term for the gauge fields of this form. And the eigenvalues of this mass matrix are given here. They have this this characteristic form. They go like sine squared pi k over n, and so if k is much smaller than n, this is a spectrum which is equidistant and is quantized in units of 1 over r. So we attempted to call this combination the VEV and n the inverse radius. In more detail, the nk squareds are the eigenvalues of this Mach matrix, which can be read out here from this term. And the diagonalization matrix is given here. It's amusing to know that all the supersymmetric cases have brain realizations. I should mention this because it turns out they worked on deconstruction before everybody else. I just didn't know it. The n equal 1 Susy generalization is the following. We replace the gauge fields at the links by vector superfields. And we replace the scalar fields on the, sorry, the gauge fields on the vertices by vector superfields. And we replace the scalar fields on the links with chiral superfields. And it turns out the theories that we get is theories that were studied a long time ago. And those are simply Zn orbitals of the Hanani-Whitney theory. The details of this brain construction are not very important, but suffices to say that what is important is that we have a set of 2n V4 brains, which are allowed to move only in one plane, x4 plus ix5, and the Zn orbital grades this SU2n Hanani-Whitney theory to SU2 to Vn. And if you want to move the brains away from the orbital point, we have to move them in. If you move a brain here, the orbital symmetry requires that you move all the images. And so moving the brains away from the orbital point breaks these groups into the diagonal gauge group. And this complicated mass matrix that we gave, these eigenvalues are very easily obtained from this construction because you can simply look at the string stretching between this brain and its image. And the length of the string gives us the mass of the first excited state. The length of this string gives us the mass of the second excited state, and so on. And so from this diagram, using trigonometry, we can get the same mass spectrum, that the mass of the k excitations is 2b sine pi k over n. So using this picture, one can argue that in the large B limit, this collection of brain becomes like a straight infinite chain of brains, and you could use t-duality to argue that this really becomes a five-dimensional theory.
The fact that the five-dimensional theory isn't renormalizable, it means this limit doesn't really exist?
Of course. Yes. That's coming. Yes. Yes, I'll be honest. So the dictionary that you arrived at is the following. So as I said, this combination 2 pi r, the length of the circle, is simply n divided by the vet that throws the SU2 to the n group, to the diagonal group. And this 1 over v I will also call the lattice spacing. The five-dimensional gauge group is simply the diagonal gauge group in which we broke the product gauge group. And it has all kinds of, it has a finite tower of Kaluza Klein modes for finite n, which are charged in this gauge group. And finally, we can look at the gauge coupling of this group. And at one loop, the following matching relation is correct, that the gauge coupling of this group, as it would be at the scale V, where the product group was broken to the diagonal, is given by n, divided by the gauge coupling of an individual SU2 gauge group. So if you want to take a continuum limit, we want to take n to infinity, and V to infinity are equivalent to A to 0, by keeping this thing fixed. And if you also want a finite coupling, so we take n to infinity, we want a finite coupling of the diagonal group, we find that we have to go to the strong coupling limit. And so, indeed, this continuum limit we cannot really take. So, having finite coupling means that we have to be happy with having finite n. Not surprising. So, what we're interested in now is to look how the instantons fit in this construction business. So, well, we have n gauge group. So clearly, there is various possibilities to consider instantons in various gauge groups of these moves. the possibility which would be of most interest to us is to take one instant out from each gauge group. So in terms of the SU2 to the N theory, this is really an SU and N instant out. This configuration where you take one instant out from each gauge group clearly has topological charge 1 under the diagonal gauge group. So this probably needs to be. The easiest way to see this is to look at the, not at the gauge couplings, but at the strong coupling scale. So lambda is e to the, lambda to the b0 and c to the I, 8 pi squared over g squared plus I beta. Modulus some 2 pi's here, I don't remember. But we can compare the scales of the diagonal gauge group. So the following scale matching relation is true. The scale of the diagonal gauge group times r to the power of the 4-dimensional beta function of the diagonal group is related to the scales of the individual groups in this form. So, if you remember now that lambda to the b0 essentially is what the contribution of one instanton is proportional to. This formula tells us that we need n instantons in the high energy theory to get one instanton in the low energy theory. That's the quickest way to see that. So this configuration, when we have one instanton in each gauge group, is really an instanton in the deconstructed theory, and it's a one instanton in the diagonal four-dimensional gauge group. Most importantly is that in the five-dimensional piece, in the 5D phase, where we are along these flat directions for, well, I shouldn't say flat directions, where we have expectation values that break the propagation to the diagonal, we have this term where where there are masses for n minus 1 of the gauge groups. So this term is responsible for the fact that the only possible solution in this theory is when the gauge fields on two neighboring gauge groups are the same. Well, this, so this, if the configuration obeys this, then this term vanishes. So what this means is that all the n instantons that you took in the n gauge groups have the same orientation, center, and size, because this is what this requirement means. Of course, we expect that when the scale rho becomes comparable to the scale v, these instantons will, in some sense, dissociate. So what we have here, if, well, this is very pictorial, but we have one instanton in each gauge group, and I have denoted the fact that they're all oriented in the same way by having these arrows pointing in the same direction. So this we expect to be true when the size is much smaller than the lattice spacing. When the size approaches the lattice spacing, of course, the role of this term will diminish, and we expect to have n separate instantons that dissociate and have separate collective coordinates. We call these instantons the diagonal instantons. Of course, we can have instantons in K of the n SU2i gauge groups. And those instantons one can call fractional instantons. Those will have some fractional charge under the diagonal gauge group. Now, we believe that these are lattice artifacts. Why is that? First of all, they don't have a continuum five-dimensional analog. What these solutions would correspond to, they would correspond to fully five-dimensional localized finite action Euclidean solutions, because they involve a finite number of lattice sizes, so this means they're localized in the extra dimension. And these are not null, at least with any finite size. And more importantly, our work on supersymmetric theories showed that they don't contribute to the cyber-Witten curves of the compactified five-dimensional theory. So, of course, this is no proof in a general theory, but we will simply ignore them for now.
Is it somehow related to photons or something like that?
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay. This fractional charging is twisted upon the pendulum.
It's possible. I don't know. So this is just saying that we will ignore these instantons based on our experience in the supersymmetric case. We will ignore the fractional ones. And we will concentrate on the diagonal ones. They will be the ones that we will consider in the non-supersymmetric case. And so what we need to find now is since classically the diagonal instantons have arbitrary size. We want to see how the quantum fluctuations affect the dependence of the amplitude on the size. More precisely speaking, what we need to find is the determinant of the KK modes in this Bayes EDST background, and especially its rho dependency. So in general, this is complicated because KK modes are massive, n
and the determinants of massive fields in instanton backgrounds are not known exactly. But we can circumvent that by inventing an approximation. And the approximation that we'll consider, we call it a step function approximation. I'm not sure where the name came from. But let's consider instantons of a given size. So the scale that, this is a scale of the masses of the various excitations. In this theory, masses go like 1 over r, 2 over r, 3 over r, up to a certain point where they become different than this and basically approach this finite limit 2b, which is the mass of the highest excitation. So let's pick the size of the instanton 1 over rho. So there will be a number of kk modes which are lighter than 1 over rho. 1 over rho, you can think of as some characteristic mass scale associated with instanton. So a number of kk modes is lighter than that. And if 1 over rho is sufficiently smaller than the newly cutoff, you can approximate this number of lighter modes by simply the integer bar part of r over rho. That's what it is. So we'll treat these modes, which are lighter than the instanton, as masses, essentially. The modes that are heavier than 1 over rho, we will basically treat as infinity masses, and they will be relevant, decouple, and essentially they will modify the coupling. Of course, one has to be careful, because you can't treat these things strictly as masses. The reason is that there is a zero mode where the mass goes to zero. So one has to be a little bit more careful. But essentially, this approximation is like when we match beta functions. I must say that we can do better than this, and I'll just give you the result. So after this, we will demand that the instanton amplitude be continuous in rho as rho goes to various kk thresholds. And we will also demand that there is renormalization group invariance with respect to the ultraviolet curve of M. So I don't want to introduce extra confusion here. So V is the ultraviolet cutoff of the five-dimensional theory, the deconstructed five-dimensional theory. Now, this theory that we're considering, of course, is a four-dimensional gauge theory. So we need another cutoff to do calculations in this theory. That cutoff I'll call M. Generically, we'll take that cutoff to be bigger than the cutoff of the five dimension. So this is the cutoff that I demand renormalization group invariance with respect to, because this is a four-dimensional theory, and it shouldn't depend on the choice of that scale M. It's a renormalizable theory. So here is the result of the calculation in formulae. This is the most technically heavy transparency that I have, so there'll be a picture on the next one. But what happens here is that we have a usual Coote suppression factor. We have an n instanton, so there is an n in front of that. And this is the bare coupling defined at the scale of the cutoff, as usual in instanton calculations. And there are various factors that come from various quantum fluctuations. I'll just enumerate them. So the bosonic zero modes contribute this anti-screening factor for SU2 of 8, logarithm of the cutoff scale times the size of the instanton. Then there are various non-zero modes of the zero component of the gauge field and the zero mode of the five-dimensional of A5, which contribute minus 1. And then there are light fields, which are k of rho, the number of fields lighter than the instanton, the 1 over rho. There is a 2 because they can go left and right, and this factor is, essentially the same log that is here. And finally, this factor takes care of the fact that the determinants have zero eigenvalues when the various kk masses go to zero, so they have to blow up when that goes to zero. And this is the contribution of the heavy particles, essentially, to the running computation of this. So this expression, it is easy to verify, is renormalization group invariant with respect to changing the cutoff in the four-dimensional sense. This is a renormalizable four-dimensional theory. It is continuous across thresholds. You can change rho here over kk thresholds, and this is continuous. So we can take this expression, exponentiate, massage the sums. We can use the renormalization group equations of the deconstructed theory and arrive at a very simple expression for the instanton amplitude. So in physical applications, we choose to keep the coupling at the low energy scale fixed, because this is the four-dimensional coupling that one observes at the scale 1 over rho. So this is the usual Coote suppression factor that one will get in four dimensions. Then there is this factor, which is the usual four-dimensional beta function. Since we are considering just a pure gauge theory in four dimensions, this asymptotically created coefficient turns out to be so. And this is the interesting contribution of the KK modes to the instant amplitude. So it goes with the minus sign, and it is a sum of logs, and the logs have a form mk rho, where one only sums over the particles which are lighter than 1 over rho. And since this mk rho is less than 0, less than 1, this log is less than 0, so it's clear that this is a positive contribution to the exponent. And so one can now plug the KK spectrum and use the usual Stirling formula or whatnot, and arrive at the conclusion that what this term leads to is a linear growth of the amplitude when rho is much smaller than the size of the circle. So this can be viewed as our main result in this case. We have shown that the contributions of KK modes lighter than the instantons to the instanton amplitude lead to an exponential growth of the instanton amplitude when the size of the instanton becomes smaller than the radius. So I mentioned that we can do better than this approximation, and that involves doing threshold better. Namely, again, we don't have an exact formula for mass determinants, but we can use the low mass expansion, the high mass expansion, and do some interpolation. And especially, I should note this late paper of 2000, which saved us a lot of work. But it turns out this interpolation had never been done. We were on our way, but then we found this paper, so we're very happy. So this coefficient gets replaced by something like this. So here's a picture and a discussion. So the instanton amplitude is proportional to this e to the minus s effective of rho. You can call it the instanton density. So I have depicted here as a function of the instanton size rho. So let us start with sizes which are much bigger than r. So this is essentially instantons with bigger than the radius of the x dimensions. So in this case, of course, the theory is four-dimensional. Everything is heavier than 1 over rho. And so one gets the four-dimensional amplitude in an asymptotically free theory. As one decreases the instanton size, the action increases, and the amplitude, of course, decreases exponentially. So usually, in four dimensions, in QCD, for example, the semi-classical approximation breaks down because very large instantons need very strong coupling that we can calculate. In electroweak theory, we have a balancing potential, and so we have a calculable minimum that leads to the exponentially small tooth cross-section. So this physics in infrared is, of course, reproduced. In a five-dimensional supersymmetric theory, what happened, because all the quantum fluctuations of non-zero modes cancel, the amplitude is governed simply by the four-dimensional beta function. So the answer for the amplitude is the same as in four dimensions. There is no modification. Small instantons are irrelevant, and they don't contribute. And it's purely 4D physics that determines the strength of the amplitude. So what happens if we depart from supersymmetry is that fluctuations of Kaluza-Klein modes become important, and at some point, well, this is the order. At some point, when the scale, when the size of the instanton becomes much smaller than r, order r to the 10, this effective action receives this linear growing contribution. And I must say that this result here is also true in a simple KK picture, simply ignoring the heavy states. What the construction did for us here is to allow us to renormalize the amplitude in a way that we understand, and makes it very easy. So, of course, when the size of the instanton becomes much, much smaller than r and starts approaching the lens cutoff, of course, we expect instantons to dissociate, and we really don't know how well. We expect instantons to dissociate, and the calculation to become very complicated. But if we decrease the size even much below the lattice cutoff, which we can do, because this deconstructed theory is an asymptotically free theory, and what happens is these instantons dissociate. They have separate sides, sizes, centers, orientations, and so on. And so, because each group is asymptotically free, of course, the effective action will start rising again. And so the amplitude will be also exponentially suppressed for very, very small instantons. Of course, this, from here on, everything is just deconstruction. It's not, we don't expect that to be true in a general unit completion. So, of course, I shouldn't be plotting here this on the same graph, because this is just one size, And here we have n sizes because we really have n isotopes, but it's just for tutorial purposes. But what does this teach us? It teaches that the defective action here decreases. This is a robust result. And it here increases, so there must be a minimum somewhere in between. So we expect that minimum to be for instantons of order the lattice spacing, of course. And this proves the existence of this minimum. And so what we have shown here is that there is a UD contribution to the instanton amplitude, and this UD contribution can be exponentially larger than the Fourier contribution. If we include matter fields, for example, if you take an SU2 theory with NF four-dimensional Dirac fermions, we get the following result. This gets a negative contribution for the fermions. So for a small number of fermions, of course, the amplitude also grows for small size instantons. This also shows what we expected qualitatively, that fermions tend to suppress small instantons because of the division of Pauli principle. And what else does this teach us? Well, it teaches us that if we do a naive extrapolation, if we say that we go to very, very small instantons, for the g squared r over 8 pi squared, namely, if we go to instantons so small that they're, for example, of order 137 kk modes, which are lighter than that, if we trust this formula, this means that we have shown that the instanton cross-section has become unsuppressed. Of course, there is a law of semi-classical calculations, which says that the instanton amplitude is small whenever the calculation was valid. And that, of course, holds here as well. And if I write this result in terms of the parameters of the deconstructive theory, this is how it looks. There is an e to the minus n overall factor. And this is the gauge coupling of an individual SU2 theory at the scale B. And this is the extra factor that comes from the various determinants, the various things of line loads. Now, where is this calculation valid? It's a weakly coupled calculation, so we need the coupling of each group to be small. This means that this factor is very large. And we also assume that the instantons are all oriented the same way, and there is no dissociation. So this means that rho v is much bigger than 1. So in the regime when the calculation is valid, of course, this amplitude is still exponentially suppressed. You don't expect it to happen otherwise. So to summarize, we showed that in a non-supersymmetric 5D theory on a circle, if there are not too many Bode fermions, the small instanton amplitudes exhibit exponential growth. We used deconstruction, and we showed within the deconstruction as a UD completion that there is a new extra dimensional minimum for instantons of order with size of order the lattice spacing. And in this new extra dimensional minimum, the amplitude can be exponentially larger than the four dimensional infrared contribution. Now, this formula can be applied to more general backgrounds. They can be applied to S1 and Z2. They can be applied to warm backgrounds. In particular, I think I worked out the warp case today. And not surprisingly, the result for the instanton amplitude is the same as in four dimensions. Using the results from the talk on Monday, I believe. In SUSY orbitals, for example, with this 5D theory is almost supersymmetric, the SUSY cancellations I referred to still persist. So there is no ultraviolet dominance of the instanton amplitude if on the SUSY orbitals. At most, one can get a logarithmic growth. So this transparency exhausts the results. And now I will just do some speculations. So the instantons that we've been considering are independent of the fifth coordinate. In fact, we argue that these were the only ones that have topological charge 1 under the low energy four-dimensional engagement. So basically, they look like thin tubes, and the thickness of the tube is of order rho, where rho is the size of the instanton, and their length is of order 2 pi r. So since they are independent of S5, the interaction they induce does not depend on whether the fermions, so if the instanton induces an interaction that involves fermions, because various zero modes have to be, integrals over zero modes have to be saturated. The interaction they induce does not depend on whether fermions are localized in X5 or not. In other words, these instantons induce a non-local in X5 interaction. And even if the fermions had some
even if the fermions are localized at different points, this interaction doesn't care about it. The usual wave function overlap suppression is absent, since there is no integral over x5 in the amplitude. Of course, within the framework where our calculation is valid, there is still this exponential suppression, and any semi-classical calculation will yield a suppression like this, r over g pi squared, or e to the minus m. But of course, in a general UV completion, the UV is strongly coupled, and one could expect that an exponential suppression could become a power law suppression. For example, this e to the minus r over g pi squared could become a suppression like this, which in terms of m would mean that e to the minus m could become a Langevin suppression. We don't know. In particular, something like that happens with the eta prime mass in QCD. If one does a semi-classical calculation, of course, the eta prime mass would be exponentially small, but we know that it is not composed like 1 over n. So, of course, we cannot answer this using this UV completion. So, one final comment is that even with an order 1 suppression, if we have this operator with 9 quarks and 3 leptons suppressed by a scale of order 10 TeV, because it's such a high dimension, it's totally negligible at low energies. The Deuteron lifetime that follows from this is an order 10 to the 46 years or something huge like that. So the best one we hope for within this framework is that this very number violation will become strong at energies of order 10 TeV. So those of us who are older remember that this prediction was made before, about 12 years ago, for very different reasons. so we are back. And one final comment is that 6D is bound, as usual, to be much more fun. So that's really all I have to say.
Your questions for Eric?
Yes.
So you said that you find this new minimum at the lattice spacing?
Yes.
So how am I supposed to interpret that in the continuum limit? What lesson am I supposed to draw?
I don't know. You can't take the continuum limit, right? It's a strong coupling limit.
So does it depend on the low energy coupling and the better content?
Yes, sure. Yeah. Well, just like that.
Yeah.
Huge loop. I mean, if you take this formula, if you take it at face value, right, the exponential suppression disappears. But simultaneously with that, your approximation breaks down. So, by the way, this is very reminiscent of the linear running. Right? It's very reminiscent of the linear running. However, the coefficient is not the same. It's not the what you would call the beta function in the vacuum theory. It's something different. Maybe you would say that, you know, if you have linear running, you know, you should get something like that. So there is some difference in the coefficients. For example, if you take a 5D SU2 super young Mills, so basically n equal to 4-dimensional theory lifted to 5 dimensions, then in the beta function, the coefficient of the linear running is m8 minus nf, where nf is the number of hypermultiplets. So for nf less than 7 or less, it's actually kind of asymptotically free. Whereas in the instanton calculation, which we also did for the supersymmetric case, but it's not shown here, the coefficient is 4 minus nf. So this is not the 5-dimensional what you would call data function. So, but I don't know how to take a continuum.
You see that if you consider the quantum fraction of 5 dimensional
yes,
two ways to see that, for instance, you can design the momentum dependence, or you can become cutoff dependence.
Yes.
I mean, you can impose some fraction which is linear in external momentum, or a piece which is linear in cutoff.
Yes.
So, function, which question is deeper. Maybe I definitely have predicted.
Maybe I haven't thought about it that way. I would be happy to talk with you about it. This is really all the construction. But this actually also falls in the continuum. This is a
Yes. On the question, is it straightforward to generalize the calculation to all the gauge groups?
I believe so. I have a student who is doing that, so I'll do it.
prove five-dimensional instantons by twisting your chain of instantons by a SU2 rotation as you go around? The thing that sits at pi 4 of SU2. Have you thought about that?
I have no idea.
The thing is, the only way I know how to think of this is using this instruction, or rather, I haven't thought about it any other way. So, because I have this mass curve, anything for which the gauge field is not the same, including gauge transformation, does not solve the equations of motion, right? Because this term is here, d a mu I minus a mu I minus 1 squared. So the instanton is a solution of the equation of motion without mass terms. So this term only vanishes when any two neighboring a's are the same. And if you do a gauge transformation, then it's not a solution anymore. No. Maybe there is a sense in which it is approximately a solution dependent. It gets very complicated.
But this, here you've assumed that your condensate is a constant, that gives you sort of twist into one along.
Yes. This part here is actually in the construction. This is calculable, but it doesn't mean that it's easy to calculate. You have really an n-instanton problem, and not just an n-instanton problem, but an n minus 1 constraint and one unconstraint, right? Because you have masses for n minus 1 engagements. So it's
Something is missing.
Yes.
I don't understand. Yes. It's a series gauge invariant, right?
Yes.
So essentially, let's assume that you have a specific gauge, you know the solution, and after that, you make the transformation. And you're supposed to get exactly the same same classical action.
Oh,
I can pick up instanton in one gauge, I can just change this gauge. I definitely know that instanton exists in the different gauge, action is the same. So what I'm saying is,
the first thing that comes to mind is to say that there is only the diagonal group which is unbroken, everything else is broken.
Yeah, it's broken, but you know it is a broken not in the way as we understand it's completely broken. You know, you can make rotation as Gordon suggested, your scalar fields and everything. You do all these rotations and just everything should be exactly the same, no matter what kind of gauge you use.
Like if you twist the condensate as you go around the loop.
Yes.
Yeah, then you wouldn't have this mass curve, but you have the twisted very kind of.
Yeah, I cannot comment on that.
Yeah, and another comment about interaction, that usually what happens in physics and in other theories, that when you get to this point, I would suspect that essentially interaction between two different instantons is extremely important. So essentially, you cannot apply your dilute gas approximation in this region. Right?
But these are instantons in different gauge groups. Oh, you mean between two different search of it.
Yeah. So essentially the way how you formulated the problem from the very beginning, you say, okay, we use standard Toft calculations,
yes,
and nothing but dilute gas approximation, and forget about everything else.
Sure.
But nevertheless, you definitely understand that at some point it cannot be correct.
But as long as I keep the coupling weak, how can that be a problem?
You know, for example, for QCD, you can, as you know, the coupling can be extremely small, but nevertheless, interaction cannot be neglected. And just this is exactly the reason why we have unitarity and all this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm
supposed to
use open data series. As Kelly and Smith is waiting for my lecture.
Yes.
Yes,
in this case, that's actually.
But in his case, maybe
it is not exactly his case.
Oh yeah, but you may assume that in the test at this minimum point, at A, if you just assume the still theory is more or less the coupling.
Yes, it is. Yes,
yes. You can fine tune your coupling to make that still the theory to be coupled at A, then it can be more interesting.
I think that's the
way.
Any more questions? Shall we thank Greg again?